Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Hausman, visiting instructor of history at the University of Pittsburgh and your host for this channel. Today, I'm excited to be speaking with Kent Blancett. Dr. Blancett is Charles Mary Caldwell Martin Professor of Western American History at the University of Nebraska-Omaha and has written several articles for American Indian Quarterly, Indian Country Today, and several other outlets. Today, we're talking about his fantastic new book, A Journey to Freedom, Richard Oakes, Alcatraz, and the Red Power Movement, which came out with Yale University Press in 2018 as part of their Henry Rowe Cloud series on American Indians and Modernity. Kent, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's begin by hearing first about you. Tell us about yourself, how you became interested in history, and your academic background.
Great. I come from five tribes, so Cherokee, Creek, Choctaw, Shawnee, and Potawatomi. I'm a descendant through my father's side. I come from the family lines of Panther, Blanket, as well as the quintessential Indian name of Smith. And of course, out of that, I grew up in a very small town in the Ozarks, kind of close to the other four corners of Missouri, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Kansas, as I call it. And growing up, I first started thinking about being a historian when I entered my undergraduate at the University of Missouri at Columbia. And I got involved in activism there, and we were working for about 4 years on the repatriation movement. The university there had about 3,000 remains of Native peoples that they kept for scientific study. And part of our desire as a Native student organization was in the very early 90s, after NAGPRA had passed, to get those remains of our ancestors repatriated back to their tribes. So I got involved in activism, but I was just a big indigenous nerd as well, not just a heavy activist. And so I found myself really in the e-stacks of the library. And part of that was that growing up in a small Ozarkian town, we had literally two books on Native history in my high school, which was Custer Died for Your Sins. It came out in 1969 by one of the great Native intellectuals, Vine Deloria, and then another book on the Cherokee Tragedy by, I believe it's Wilkinson. And, you know, and I had read those books cover to cover, but I thought, you know, before I went to college, you know, this is before the days of internet, I thought these were the only really two books that existed on Native history. And when I got to college and I discovered the e-stacks, I was just, you know, like in Willy Wonka, I had the golden ticket. And I couldn't get enough of the books. I just started preparing my own kind of lectures, and I would stay up till 2 or 3 in the morning pulling books off the shelf, reading as much as I could get. And, you know, it was really one of those things that I decided to go from pre-law pretty quick to becoming a historian. And part of that is I didn't want no other student to go through this country without ever learning their history, especially Native history. And that became another part of my activism was through the classroom. But through 4 years of fighting on repatriation, I began reading about Red Power and wanting to know more about what other Native leaders had done in the past. And, you know, it is at that point I started learning about, you know, Alcatraz, I started learning about Peltier, I started learning about BIA takeovers and the American Indian Movement and Wounded Knee in 73. And, you know, out of all that reading and kind of learning about what the generation before us had done, I you know, came across Richard's name a time or two, and it, the information on him was always just rather, you know, brief, rather, you know, Richard pretty much just kind of showed up, and then there was this takeover, and he happened to be a student, and then he kind of drops out of history out of after Alcatraz, and we don't really hear much about his kind of before or after story, and that really stayed with me as a young Native, you know, intellectual who was involved in activism. I just kind of always wanted to know more, and when I did my my master's degree at the University of New Mexico, I took a course by Frank Saz, who taught a biography seminar. And in that biography seminar, he went around the room and had everybody say, you know, I want you to write about somebody you've always just kind of wanted to know a little bit more about. And it just was automatic for me. It was Richard Oakes. And so that kind of started this journey about 18 years ago. And I started just trying to think of anything and everything and shake America to literally have anything with Richard's name tied to it kind of fall out as a historian and try to use it for this book. And some of that had to do with collecting oral histories and going from coast to coast, from New York to California, to going into Canada and Ganawage and McGill University and archives and special collections and, you know, using newspaper documents and periodicals, radio shows, television, in order to be able to piece together Richard's life story. And, you know, early on, some people thought, you know, because he only lived to be about 30 years old, that this would be kind of an impossible story to write about. Like, you know, really, you know, how do you write a biography of a guy who only lives to be 30? And, you know, how do you make this significant? And how does his narrative change the narrative of how we understand the 20th century and Native history and or Red Power? And what I hoped is that the final product of this book does just that. It changes the narrative for us and how we understand Red Power, but how we understand the importance of this movement of Alcatraz and kind of creating the 20th century Native experience, and more importantly, the launching of a civil rights / human rights movement that really ushers in the era of self-determination that, you know, really defined and gave opportunity to my generation.
Yeah, and all that coast-to-coast research that you're describing, it's all there on the page, because the story of Oakes's life is told pretty in-depth in the book, at least I found it to be, certainly. So, yeah, that was impressive to me. I want to ask a question that is actually not on the list of questions that that you and I had discussed beforehand, if that's all right. And that is about biography. And, you know, I've certainly never written a biography of someone myself. And I'm just curious what some of the challenges and some of the rewards are of writing biography as a genre. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, no, it was rather challenging because, like I was just saying, you know, Richard's life is so short, but it's so dynamic. One of the things I started doing is really trying to read other Native biographies, but there's very few that have been written by Native peoples or Native historians or scholars. So that was really instrumental for me to try to jump into a narrative that oftentimes has been defined by some of the greats like John Neidhart to Angie DeBow and others, you know, of Western history, but really trying to insert in more of a Native voice into that genre. And what it came to me is to say, you know, I really wanted to focus this on telling a piece about not just an individual, but being able to not separate the individual from place and space. And what that meant was being able to start this biography with talking about a history of Akwesasne and Ganawage in order for people to understand the community that Richard Oakes was born into. And more importantly, using him then as a lens to examine how this community evolves over time, whether that's the Mohawk city of Brooklyn to the Indian cities of San Francisco and Seattle, Richard becomes a lens in which we can investigate the urban Indian experience, not just the Red Power movement, and see how, you know, place and space interact with Native politics in really unique ways. Biography for me was kind of critical as a episode of methodology and theoretic, but this became more kind of a community biography as I moved into the project and got more in depth into it. And he became more of a lens to be able to examine some of these larger issues that took me in different places and into different interpretations that were completely unexpected. And some of that was, discovering new ideas of thinking about Native history as intertribal histories, not just your strict tribal histories that have been done for so long, which was, setting out in a graduate school or in a PhD program and thinking, well, I'm going to write the history of the Lakota people, or I'm going to write the history of the Cherokee people. And, that was pretty standard. And we have, as far as formulaic in the methodology of doing Native history, for some time now. And I really wanted to do a 20th century piece that was looking at the core component of what does that intertribal space look like. And one way of getting at that intertribal space was being able to use a person's life to showcase that. Another part of that was the space itself and looking at the urban Indian experience through in the lens of the individual. Other than that, between intertribalism and the Indian city, it was then to examine our politics in this movement between Native nationalism to Red Power, and what really defines Red Power as a movement, not in opposition to Native nationalism, but as a bridge, an extension of Native nationalism in the 20th century.
Well, let's talk about that definition for a bit, because kind of getting into the book now, your introduction contains several definitions and does a really excellent job, I thought, of explaining some really complicated ideas in very well and in very crisp, clear language. So can you give us a definition of Red Power as you describe it and define it in the book?
That's a wonderful question. And what I love about it is that looking back, a lot of people have avoided trying to define Red Power as scholars. Most people center on the great intellectual of Vine Deloria and his books in 1969, as far as Custer Died for Your Sins. And then there's a cast of Red Power literature that really starts emerging in the mid-1990s with Troy Johnson's book on the occupation of Alcatraz, to then Robert Warrior and Paul Chad Smith's, Like a Hurricane. And then in other vignette books like Peter Mathiasen's In the Spirit of Crazy Horse and others. And so Red Power was just kind of left on a cloud, so to speak, and really nobody's kind of come in to reshape it. And I think we're far enough removed now that we're able to kind of, investigate, what is this kind of movement? And really what I began to find is that the movement itself had been typecasted a lot as being militant, for one, which it was absolutely not. It was a nonviolent movement. There was different pockets of this movement and its philosophical and ideological expression, whether that be the West Coast movement or the Minneapolis movement or the Denver movement or the Cleveland movement. It was also tied to urban environments explicitly. And it grew out of Native nationalism, which was a movement to protect indigenous sovereignty as a very key term, going back, a sovereignty that goes back and dates prior to colonization. And prior to even treaties. And that nationalism informs Red Power, and Red Power became kind of this object in which Native peoples organize intertribally, and they bring that organization in a way to funnel and help and protect Native nationalism and indigenous sovereignty and further those aims and means. And beyond just the political element of Red Power becomes a field in and of itself in Native history. In other words, it's like I tell my students with Buffy St. Marie, she always said, I can do what takes Vine Deloria 300 pages to do, I can do in 3 minutes in a song and reach far more millions of people via the stage than Vine could ever do in his book. So there's another extension of Red Power, which is the stage itself. It's the activists, it's the literature, it's the movies, it's the film. And that Red Power in and of itself is worthy of its own field of study within the canon of Native American studies, let alone Native history or the American West. And so I'm really hopeful is that by creating these definitions, which are meant to be built upon, that it allows this field to kind of flourish a little bit more, and that we can see these elements of urbanity and intertribalism informing a rather large movement of the extension of Native nationalism into the future of this, kind of these kinds of studies.
Let's start talking about Richard Oakes's life. And as you've said in this interview, and as you argue in the book, place and space are critical to the story that you are telling. So can you tell us first, where is Akwesasne, and what was that place like in the first half of the 20th century?
Excellent. Yeah, no. With Akwesasne, Richard always described it as kind of a place of about 3,000 people and 3,000 problems. And it's an intriguing place because it's a borderlands community, which straddles the border between Canada and the United States. Not only does it straddle the border between Canada and the United States in upper New York, but it also is bisected by two provinces, which is Quebec and Ontario, that cuts it too on the Canadian side. What Richard experienced with politics at Akwesasne, they're highly charged between dealing with the Indian Act on the Canadian side, which was established in 1876, that gives at least a lot of the jurisdiction to the provinces, to then on the American side dealing with the IRA or dealing with at least band councils as well and state governments and federal governments. What he was essentially pointing out is that it was a highly political place, oftentimes always in conflict and entrenched in the protection of the longhouse, and that the longhouse, as far as the governing structure for the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, was something that was always having its sovereignty infringed upon by these outside political forces. So Richard essentially was born into this highly charged political community that had always been organizing and had always been in an activist wing. In other words, his activism just didn't start at Alcatraz. It started with his home community and in the voice of Mohawk nationalism and Native nationalism. And we see this really in the development of Akwesasne in the trades of not only lacrosse and the manufacture of lacrosse sticks, which they eventually dominated the market. They made 90% of the world's lacrosse sticks there at Akwesasne. And this was a business that was shared between men and women, that was gender equal. Men helped with the manufacturing of the stick itself. Women did the netting of the stick. And so there was a kind of balance and equity involved in this kind of traditional art form that was made into a world sport that then became very profitable for the community. The other industry that we begin to see this kind of traditionalism within is the business of ironwork. And for Richard, what I had to do is showcase this by reaching out to the sister community of Ganawage, and which is another Mohawk community on the Canadian side that is outside the city of Montreal. And they were one of the first Mohawk communities to really get involved in the ironwork industry, but it was through timber frame construction and those bridges at the mid-19th century. And part of this was that Montreal wanted to get, you know, product and export across the Lachine Rapids and the St. Lawrence Seaway. And those were some, you know, heavy rapids. I mean, at Ganawage, there was these boat drivers that would take tourists down those as kind of like a modern-day roller coaster ride, if you will, or thrill-seeking ride. But they were highly dangerous, and it was hard to get product across. So Montreal essentially goes to Ganawage and says, let's build a bridge. Let's make it timber frame construction. We need to use Ganawage territory, Ganawage lands to do it. Do we have your permission? Well, the leaders there were ingenious, and they said, well, you know, you can have our permission, except you have to hire Ganawage Mohawks to build that bridge. And what they did is they ushered in a new era of job training and job skills for Ganawage Mohawks. And as that industry shifted from timber frame construction, it eventually shifted into iron construction, and they brought in more iron workers from Akwesasne. And that iron worker force really set itself up in the industry in Manhattan in that boom cycle at the beginning of the 20th century, when Manhattan was growing by leaps and bounds, and they were building the Chrysler Building, Rockefeller Center, Empire State Building. They were hiring Mohawk workers. I mean, Mohawks constituted eventually 15% of the iron working labor force in New York City that built that most famous skyline. And we don't see that, right? When we look at the Empire State Building, we don't see Native ingenuity. And I'm hoping with this book, people see it in a different way now. And they see, you know, that Native ingenuity in the building and the construction of one of the world's most famous cities. And Mohawks, you know, of course, we're being told at the time that, you know, well, they're Indian. So, of course, we have supernatural or human abilities to be able to defy gravity, or we have no sense of fear, you know, from our warrior past of walking 60 to 80 floors up without a harness. And that was simply not true. And a lot of those Mohawk workers would say, yeah, we were scared. People died in this industry. And because people died in this industry, and because there was very little safety regulations kind of early on, it meant it was an open workforce that Mohawks could exploit and not face discrimination. I mean, they would take anybody that would be able to work 80 to 60 floors up at a time. And so that meant that this was kind of a workforce or occupation that had very little discrimination that they could take a commanding presence in. And they did. And they found ways to be able to deal with that stress. They found ways in which to be able to kind of, you know, become or have this become an integral part of not only their community, but also their economy. As Mohawk City was being built in Brooklyn by the turn of the 20th century, it started first out in Queens, and then it would move, you know, by the turn of the 20s or 1920s more into Brooklyn. And then it really shot up by the 1940s and 50s with the iron working trade. And Richard became a part of both of those communities between Akwesasne and Brooklyn. And it wasn't as though when Mohawks went to the city, they forgot to be Mohawk. There was no sense of this great melting pot kind of theory where, you know, that we'd all been told by Schoolhouse Rock, which is, you know, you essentially go to the cities and people lose their nationalism and they assume kind of a Irish American identity or German American identity. Well, we didn't lose our tribalism when we went to the cities. It became reinforced and became nationalism. And we see this in the case of Paul Daibo, who's a Ganawage who goes to the city, and he's being labeled as an illegal alien, you know, in the 1920s. And this is in the hysteria of nativism and, you know, the Origins Act and restricting of immigration and citizenship. And yet the Mohawk themselves have the Jay Treaty, and which allow them to go across the border freely. And so they Paul Daibo gets arrested. He gets deported back saying, you know, he can't be working in America as a Canadian. And he uses the Jay Treaty. They raise money and they become politically active. And eventually Paul Daibo wins out and Mohawks are allowed to come in from Canada to be able to work in the United States and to go across the border freely. And it's a huge case. And the Iroquois or the Haudenosaunee get together and they seemingly challenge notions of what does it mean to be a citizen across border? And what does this issue look like to be an illegal alien and yet at the same time be a First Nations person or indigenous to these lands? They kind of point at the contradictions of U.S. immigration history in that sense. So while they create this very vibrantly rich community, they also begin building institutions. They begin indigenizing the city and making it more Mohawk. One of the instances of that is they go into Collier's Presbyterian Church. And I found that really intriguing when I was doing my research because Dr. David Corey, who ran Collier's Church, it was a Presbyterian church, but most Mohawks, Ganawage and at Akwesasne, they're primarily Catholic. For him to create an entirely Mohawk congregation at a Presbyterian church, I was like, how is this done? Well, Corey was this kind of, you know, gregarious individual that goes and decides that he notices that the community surrounding him is largely filled with Mohawks and they're speaking a different language. And so he starts studying the Mohawk language. He begins getting a hymnal translated into Mohawk and he begins holding services in the Mohawk language. And pretty soon, what he begins to realize is that more and more Mohawks start going to the Presbyterian church, primarily because you can sing in Mohawk and you can hear the language being spoken in Mohawk. So they indigenize a Presbyterian church in that process. There's bars that are then created, the Indian bars, which become another modicum. And what I began realizing is that, you know, the church, like Corey's church, the Indian bars like Spar Bar and Grill, Wigwam, which I'm happy to go into, these became institutions of a larger Indian city. that gave Richard, as a young man growing up in Brooklyn in the 1940s and 50s, a highly charged identity as a Mohawk person. That his Mohawk identity wasn't ripped apart because he was in Brooklyn. It was re-enhanced as he moved between Akwesasne and Brooklyn. And Brooklyn became kind of a suburb to the nation, so to speak, an outlet, if you will, for a growing work industry. And those monies would be taken back and spent back at Akwesasne, and for greater political autonomy, like I just mentioned with the Paul Dibo case, in the sense of extending indigenous rights, at least in America. So out of that, you know, Richard really had a strong political education as a young man going between Akwesasne, Brooklyn, and his Ganawage relatives up north even.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Tell us more about Richard's life as a child and as a teenager. Describe his world a bit. Where was he living, and what were some of his formative experiences and encounters, both political and otherwise, as a young person that shaped him into the leader that he would become later on in his life?
Yeah, no, it was instrumental to me. I mean, one of the two things I wanted to, it took forever to track down a photo of his parents to put in the book. And so the one that I really wanted that took forever was a photo of Richard's mom, Irene Foote. His mother was actually the most influential person in his life. And part of this was is that Irene had married Arthur Oakes, and Arthur Oakes happened to be a prize fighter. He fought in tournaments and was kind of a lightweight champion in New York. He also would eventually meet up with Irene, and they would marry. And Irene was from the Canadian side of the res, and Arthur was from the American side of the res. So kind of both sides of that equation of Akwesasne. Irene had gone to residential school, unlike Arthur, so she had that experience. And Richard, and or at least Leonard, when I interviewed Richard's brother, would always mention how she was very, you know, regimental, you know, on everything. Like if they were on the phone, she would be timing their conversations on the phone to a T to make sure, you know, that they weren't spending too much money or weren't increasing the phone bill. But everything had to be regimented. She also had a hard time, and we find this a lot when we talk to that generation from that residential school area. It was harder to express emotions when they were children sent to these residential schools, and some of the traumas that they faced. It also meant that they had a hard time being able to show their emotions and give those emotions to their kids. And in some of the interviews I did with Leonard, that was the case with her mom, but it meant that they also completely loved her as well. And she operated in a time period in which there was rampant discrimination. There was for women, especially women of color. She, after marrying Arthur Oakes, had lost a couple of the children early on, and she had Richard and Leonard. And of course, Arthur was called off to war, World War II. He was serving on one of the ships during the D-Day invasion of Europe. When he came back from the war, they divorced. The war completely changed their family, like it did many American families. It wasn't the picture of the sailor bending over, you know, the young nurse in the middle of Times Square that most people experienced. It was quite a harrowing story. And at that time, you know, Irene, she didn't have much recourse or means to be able to support two children on her own. She had to put the kids in an orphanage. So the kids went to an orphanage in Syracuse for a number of years until Irene could get jobs and employment. And so she worked two jobs. She worked at a tied factory and a tool factory manufacturing. And so this was a time period coming out of Rosie the Riveter, and when which women were gaining work even in wartime industries. And so she eventually was able to work herself into getting a house in the North Park Slope area of Brooklyn. And after that, she was able to get the kids out of the orphanage, and she would raise them until about the time they were 16. And it was until Richard was kind of in his teenage years that he first met his father. So the most important person in his life happened to be his mother. And while they were in Brooklyn, of course, they played stickball just like all the other kids. They ran through, you know, different ethnic neighborhoods. There was gangs that they had to confront. And, you know, these weren't gangs by today's standards. You know, it was, you know, gangs were, you know, more or less like, you know, kids roughing up, you know, over turf and so on and so forth. You know, they could get violent, but, you know, not the type they were today. You know, and Richard had, at one point had gotten a jacket, a lacrosse jacket from one of his uncles up at Onondaga from his mother's side of the family, and was wearing this lacrosse jacket, and some kids in a gang thought this was another gang jacket and went after Richard. And, you know, what Leonard described was is that as kids, they also had to like mirror who they were. So like if they were in a rough area of an Italian neighborhood and kids kind of went after them, they would pretend to be Italian and be able to pass in order not to get roughed up. So they knew how to survive, you know, kind of even as kids. And, you know, they said it was rough, you know, in some neighborhoods when kids find out you're Indian, they really took after you. But they also learned to defend themselves. Richard got into lifting weights. They got into boxing. I think part of that was they heard stories about their dad being a boxer. So there was this kind of idolization for the father that they didn't know growing up. And that father that had been taken away and wanting to understand who he was. They got to know his father's, you know, family, like his grandparents and stuff when they would go back to Akwesasne. And I think there was a determination that really shone in Richard. And one of the early stories that Leonard told me about Richard was they were kind of young, and they were over at Akwesasne visiting grandparents. And there was this island there kind of off of one of the rivers there at Akwesasne. And it was about 1,000, you know, or so yards to be able to get over to that island. It was kind of a far distance. And there was a guy in a rowboat that challenged Richard to a race as a young man. And he said, "No, I can beat you in that rowboat." And he literally would make that swim to that island and beat the guy to the rowboat. And all the other kids at Akwesasne were like cheering him on. And it was this kind of sign of leadership that was emerging in him, where he was not ever going to be limited by the things around him. He was going to seek something bigger and better, but it not just for himself, but to lift everybody else up. There was that kind of genuineness, that kind of quality in Indian country of returning the gift. That it's not just about lifting yourself up, it's about lifting your community up along with you. And that's kind of a quality that would continue on. And then there was a lot of myth to sort through. There was a story that was told of him that isn't actually true, but it's still interesting, of Iroquois leaders going from Akwesasne to Washington, D.C. to speak to the president in the White House. And Richard skipped school and stowed away on a bus. And as the bus had pulled out from Akwesasne, he kind of jumped up underneath one of the seats. And it was too late to be able to turn the bus around. So he became an early diplomat with these Iroquois leaders. So it was, as I say, he was being put into a certain place in Iroquois politics, even in the mythology evolved around his youth and upbringing between Brooklyn and Akwesasne. And I'd say, you know, he had his first kind of test of ironwork is he met up with his father for the first time, and Leonard and him were being brought into the ironworking industry. And it was hard, backbreaking work. They were made to carry around all the boards, the heavy boards that the people used to go from beam to beam, and they had to move these boards around by the derrick operator. And Leonard said, "I got about 2 weeks in and my back was done. I wasn't going to do any more." But Richard, he kept on. He wanted to know their father a little bit more. So he dropped out of high school and he stayed with his dad and he started being a punk in an ironworking gang. And this is at the time when you're using hot rivets, and he was a catcher on the line. And so when I interviewed Dean Chavers, Chavers told me this story. And Dean Chavers, a Lumbee citizen, and had also been one of the occupiers at Alcatraz and one of the coordinators. And Chavers said he saw Richard take his shirt off one day, and he had all these scars on his chest. And he's like, oh, my gosh, you know, what happened to you? Who did that to you? And Richard got a smile on his face. He's like, well, I was an iron worker, and I was a catcher on the line. And what that meant was these kind of were the flyboys of the ironworking industry, because it took four people. You had one person that operated a bucket full of hot coals, another person who then was in charge of getting those rivets heated up and then throwing them to another person on the line. And that person was a catcher. And that the catcher had a kind of cone-shaped tin cup they would catch these red-hot rivets in, and then they would place them in the iron beams. And then you had another guy with a pneumatic hammer that would pound and taper that end in. And then as the bolts got cooled, they expanded and they filled in that joint on that iron beam. And they built these buildings one rivet, one steel beam at a time. And Richard said, you know, you get up 80 stories up and it's summertime, it's hot, you take your shirt off. And sometimes when those hot rivets come, they bounce off that can and they hit you and they sear your skin. But for him, it was this kind of idea that he wore this as a badge of honor. It was, you know, like this made him a true Mohawk, being a part of that industry, and kind of wearing that not only as a badge of honor, but learning how to organize and learning how to operate, knowing how to delegate, and being a part of this larger industry would affect his leadership well before Alcatraz ever happened. He would moonlight too, going to some universities eventually. And of course, his father and brother would continue on in working in the iron industry. One of the photos that I have of Richard's father in the book was of him being on the 110th floor of the World Trade Center. Richard's dad actually was one of the main foremen that helped build the North Tower, and then Richard's brother, Leonard, was on the South Tower of the World Trade Center. So it's important to understand that Mohawks, you know, have an integral foundation in building, you know, the World Trade Centers, and which was one of the larger buildings in New York City at the time. And Richard, you know, soon started moonlighting to get back to him, and he had a kind of falling out with his father during that time. He also was involved in a marriage with a non-native woman, in which the father, in a kind of way, was didn't want his daughter being married to an Indian, and kind of prevented him from ever going forward with that marriage. And so he, at the same point in time, lost that marriage, lost the chance to be a father, which was kind of a scar for him, I think, and being kind of estranged. And that estrangement happened because he was arrested. He broke the law. And one of the interesting stories I always love to tell is he stole a meat truck in this kind of, he was very young, and it was this kind of Robin Hood-like thing. He was there in Syracuse, and he saw this idling meat truck, and he got involved with this kind of gang and kind of ran with the wrong group of people. And they decided they would steal this meat truck and they would drive it down to the reservation down at Onondaga. And they would start handing the meat out to the people, giving free meat away, free steaks, which who wouldn't want that? And so they get down to Onondaga, and Richard's in the back of the truck handing meat out to the people, and his friends are kind of in the front of the truck, and little does he know the authorities show up, and his friends split, and Richard never saw them show up because he's too busy handing the meat out to the people for free. So he's caught red-handed, and he's sent to Elmira Reformatory, and he's sent to jail, essentially as a juvie. And he's got a record, and this is partly why the father of his first marriage prevents him from really continuing on. And he kind of feels like his world falls apart a little bit. He loses his grandparents. He kind of witnesses the death of one of his friends on the res, and this death of one of his friends spawns one of the greatest stories that I heard when I was doing interviews. When I went back to Akwesasne, they have an ironworkers festival every summer long, in which there's like the spud wrench toss, which is using it kind of like a hatchet that you kind of throw into a board and have it stick to a target. There's a rivet toss. There's trying to climb a steel beam as fast as you can all the way to the top while it's hanging or being suspended. So there's all these kind of skills tests. It's like Highland Games for ironworkers. And every year this takes place at Akwesasne. And so I went back and I was interviewing iron workers about their experiences and getting them to tell me stories about Richard that they knew. And there was one popular story that, like, you got to put in the book. It was the biggest fight in all of Indian history, in the sense of like fist fight on the reservation. And it was between him and this local tough, Peter Burns, which I was able to find a picture of Peter Burns and put in the book, which was very unique. But Peter Burns was this, you know, bigger guy on the res who was kind of seen as kind of a bully by some. And Richard had basically experienced the death of one of his friends in this horrendous kind of traffic accident that it took place on the reservation. And as the cops came and they barricaded the road up, Peter Burns was standing off with a crowd of people, and he kind of was, you know, mouthing off to the police, like, clear it out of the road, you know, I need to get back home. And at this point, it sparked a fight between the two individuals, which they said, you know, on the res, the cops pretty much told him to go off to the American side and leave them alone. And they were literally popping popcorn and watching this fight. It was like a fight that lasted 3 hours long. But it was about Richard standing up to the bully. It was about Richard defending the people. And he was a folk hero, even at the age of 16, between all of these experiences. Experiences that defined him as a leader, the person that would take chances and opportunities, the person that would stand up to injustice. And these were the qualities that defined him. And then about 1968 or so is when he decided he would leave New York. And he took out all of his earnings and he bought himself a fabulous fire engine red, you know, Mustang convertible. And which Leonard was like, you have to mention the Mustang, because he was very proud of that car. And then he would take off and he would do this kind of Gandhi-esque like trip across the country. And he would start stopping off at Native reservations. And he would start learning about, you know, hey, what is relocation done, you know, in your community? Or what is termination done, you know? And what are you guys doing to fight against getting your tribe terminated? And, you know, what's your tribal history? You know, what's your story? You know, what kind of Indian are you, you know, as they'd say. And this really sparked off kind of the first ever kind of Indigenous studies course for him. He was learning about Native history by living it, by experiencing it, by driving cross country. And where he was going was San Francisco, the city of love. But, you know, a place that, you know, is coined by hippies with beads and feathers, and the time of the Summer of the Love, and, you know, Janis Joplin and Grateful Dead, and the Beat Generation of Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg. But this wasn't necessarily the city that Richard entered into. He entered into and found an Indian city in the heart of the Mission District that had been alive and going and thriving even in well into the 1920s. And out of that, I wanted to tell that story as well. And, you know, Richard's path to get there in his childhood was absolutely instrumental in the sense of determining the type of leader that he was about to become.
Yeah, his personality really jumps off the page in the book, and he seems like he was truly an electrifying guy to know. And his personality comes across really well in the narrative that you weave here. I want to talk about that term that you just said, the term Indian city. What do you mean by that specifically? It's a term that you invented for the book, and it's a really useful one. But can you define it a bit and tell us how San Francisco fits into that rubric in the 1960s and 70s and beyond that as well?
Yeah, no. Way I've been seeing things too is, you know, in doing urban histories, there's a long historiography of this. You know, one of the first books actually was of urban Indian history was written by Dr. David Corey, same one at the Presbyterian Church. Will publish a book in the late 1940s called Between Worlds, which was really sketchy, but was kind of laying out a little bit of what does it mean that Indians are in cities. And, you know, we've always been in cities, you know, going back to ancient times, you know, to Chaco Canyon or even Cahokia, one of the world's largest cities, or Tenochtitlan. And so we've always been urban. The thing about it was, is like, even thinking about those ancient cities, we tend to relegate that as, oh, well, that was just a particular tribe of Cahokia, right? When in actuality, that was a very intertribal space. It was made up of many different nations. It was very pluralistic societies that were in those large cities like Cahokia or Tenochtitlan, for example. And the thing about it is that if that's alive in our construct of understanding ancient native cities, why is it not there when we think about, you know, ideas of 20th century urbanity? And so intertribalism becomes a kind of a key component of how Native peoples begin organizing in the cities and building in institutions, or forming institutions and organizations and businesses and bars. And those institutions then become a part of this city that we understand as Native peoples, but isn't the type of city that most people recognize, right, as being typical San Francisco. It's creating almost like a larger expanse of an ethnic neighborhood, if you will. And out of this, you know, a lot of the urban histories that have been written tend to focus on just one city, so which was critical, such as James LeGrand's India Metropolis was a major influence on me, you know, studying the urban Indian experience. Don Fixco's book, which gives a giant summary of a lot of the scholarship that came out of the 1960s and 70s when sociologists and anthropologists were studying the urban Indian experience on a large scale. Or, you know, other books like Cole Thrush's Native Seattle and or Nick Rosenthal's book on L.A. These all tend to focus on one city. And what I wanted to do with this book is really do kind of a look at multiple cities and what kinds of trends do we see coming out of these multiple cities. And what we see is that the cities are not something that is trying to assimilate necessarily or acculturate us as much as we're trying to flip the switch, so to speak, or flip the narrative and indigenize that city and use the city as a way for empowerment of our own constructs of Native nationalism and red power. And out of that, we create these institutions. And in San Francisco, one of the first of those institutions is Warren's Bar, or Warren's Slaughterhouse Bar. And that happens to be the place where Richard actually gets his one of his first jobs. I mean, ironically, his first job is that of a truck driver, which having that on his rap sheet didn't last very long. And then he goes to Warren's Slaughterhouse Bar. And Dean Chavers described that bar as one of the worst, most grungiest bars in the history of bars. It literally, there's a bar fight happening there every night. The seats are literally bolted down to the ground. There's a garage door that flips out to where they can hose it down at the end of the night. And so they have to have a garage door because they don't want people being thrown through the windows and having to replace the windows every other night. So it was a rough bar, but it was a bar in which, if you look at Russell Mean's autobiography, Where White Men Fear to Tread, he said it was the first bar that he ever heard of the term, you know, termination. And that struck me as kind of interesting, is that, you know, at a bar, it's not just about the socialization aspect of finding other Native peoples or the destructive element that alcohol sometimes plays within our community, but there's also an organizing component here in which people are talking about politics. People are sharing their stories, sharing their histories, and it becomes kind of this idea of increasing the politic of the community and community building and community engaging, that the bar became kind of a necessary cornerstone of where do you find employment. And the bar itself was located two storefronts down from the Indian Center. And Indian Centers really come about, you know, kind of that post-World War II period, in which literally what they're doing is trying to rewrite the wrongs of a government policy started by the Bureau of Indian Affairs called the Relocation Program. So it's not built through legislation, but it's built through the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And this relocation program was to at least send over 100,000 Native peoples to one of six cities, and one of those being San Francisco. And the whole idea of this, in which relocation was being managed by Dillon Meyer, and Dillon Meyer historically was in charge during World War II of the WRA, or the War Relocation Authority, for the internment of Japanese Americans. And then he shifts over to being Commissioner of Indian Affairs. And he, you know, takes the big bright idea of internment and stretches it to relocating Native peoples off of reservations into cities in the hopes that that would assimilate us and that we would cease being tribal, or we'd cease being Cherokee or Lakota or Navajo, and we would assume an Indian American or American Native kind of identity. And that just was kind of a process that was built into that system, and it was voluntary. Over 100,000 Native peoples would participate, or one in seven. But oftentimes in that program, they would prescribe that you would be given housing, you would be given an allowance to be able to get set up in that city for food and for getting furniture established, and you would be given a job. Most of the jobs that people would find on the BIA relocation program, where you could be a cosmetologist if you're a woman, or you could maybe go into auto mechanics school if you're a guy, but they were very unskilled labor kinds of jobs. There was no job training as well, or benefits to be able to further one's education. The housing was oftentimes substandard. People wound up in what would be called the Red Ghetto. And at this point in San Francisco, that would be the Mission District of San Francisco, which was largely cosmopolitan in the sense of it incorporating indigenous peoples from throughout the Western Hemisphere, from Central and South America as well, and kind of a place in which Native peoples were learning about experiences beyond just the contiguous borders of the United States, and that indigeneity has a more of a global component. Some of that being also competition with this local Samoan community. It became rather intense in those kinds of interactions with indigeneity in this time period. But the bar became one of those cornerstone institutions. Native organizations, Indian Center itself, came in to essentially give people the opportunity to pick up where the federal government failed with relocation. It would help them find jobs. It would help give them subsistence. It would help them also find a community. It would help them organize, maintain culture, maintain language, and eventually begin indigenizing the city. And out of these institutions, another one would emerge in this period of the late 1960s, which was brand new, which was Native American Studies. Oftentimes I have to tell my students, you know, we take for granted that we sometimes have Native Studies courses at universities today, but the life shelf on that is only about 50 years. It's still relatively young. It wasn't until 1969, 1970 that we really get the spark of the birth of those Native Studies departments. And Richard Oakes had been working not only at Warren Slaughterhouse Bar, but he'd been taking his kids for tutoring at the Indian Center on the second floor. And the tutors for that program were coming out of San Francisco State College. And those tutors happened to be involved, at least in the Chicano activism and with the Mexican-American student organization there at San Francisco State College. And they began recruiting Richard. They saw kind of his this very charismatic young Mohawk who had ties in the community, knew how to organize, knew how to lead, had a presence at least of recognition being a bartender at Warren's. And so they kind of, you know, gravitated to Richard in that capacity. And in late 1960s, San Francisco State was caught up in one of the largest historical college campus riots that we've ever seen. And what happened was, is essentially the students began to question, you know, why is it that my classroom doesn't look like my community, right? Why am I not able to learn about Black history or Asian history or Chicana history, or even Native history for that matter? And they began to press for ethnic studies. And out of that, the students walked off campus. And eventually the faculty walked off campus as well. And this would bring San Francisco State to its knees. It would get Ronald Reagan involved, who was then governor of California, who would be on the phone with S.I. Hayakawa, who would later become a state senator in California, who was trying to put down the student unrest. He would hire in local San Francisco police to come in and crack the skulls of the students. And this would get the students to be referring to the police as pigs. And there was tear gas canisters flowing around, and this was looking to be like an incredibly violent situation, and of course would come this violence would come to a head. And eventually, Ethnic Studies was created in 1969 at San Francisco State. And the first person that they got to be the coordinator of Native Studies would be a young Richard Oakes, who was about 27 years old at this point, to be the first coordinator of Native American Studies. And it was during this institution or building of this institution at San Francisco State that we eventually will get the springboard or launch pad for what will be the Alcatraz takeover. So the big thing was, too, is to situate Red Power within this Indian city, and that Alcatraz didn't just come out of the thin air of the fog of the bay, that it was tied into a student movement. It was tied into a community movement. It was tied into a very vibrant Indian city. And so being able to showcase that Red Power has urban roots, it was really instrumental in that, and that these Indian cities become places in which we can begin to study, and that these Indian cities have meaning within the Native political fiber of organizing, at least what are our modern notions of Native politics to this date. So the Indian city became kind of that framework, and then I eventually expanded that to a look at Seattle when later on Richard will go up there for the Fort Lawton takeovers. I wanted to be able to use Seattle as another kind of element beyond Brooklyn and the Mohawk City is the Indian city of San Fran, and then Seattle as kind of an urban Indian comparative, so that we can see how these institutions are developed and how these cities have things that parallel one another, like the development of Indian bars, the development of Indian centers, the development of Native organizations that politicize a community.
And how these various cities are also interconnected too, that none of them really exist as an island unto themselves, but that people move around between them. There's a lot of mobility as well, as one thing I noticed in the book within this concept of the Indian city too.
Yes, yes.
Let's get into the occupation of Alcatraz. And I kind of have two questions related to the occupation itself. The first one, and you touched on this a little bit, but where does the idea for the occupation come from? Why Alcatraz? And then later on, when Richard Oakes himself says that Alcatraz, and this is his quote, Alcatraz is not an island, it's an idea. What does he mean by that? So I guess it's kind of a two-part question. Why Alcatraz, and what does Alcatraz mean?
Great question. So for Alcatraz, how it starts out is, well, there's a much older occupation that takes place in 1964, which is important just for historical context, and that's coming from a group of Lakota out of San Francisco, mainly Hank Means, Richard McKenzie, and then a young Russell Means decide that they're going to take over Alcatraz. And Alcatraz, as a federal prison, is abandoned in 1963 and made into what will be surplus property. And during this period of time, there's lots of different proposals. You know, some people want to make it into a theme park. Some people wanted to make it into a museum or cultural center or shopping area. Well, at least Lakota began in San Francisco to organize and thinking, you know, critically about the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868. And within that clause is if the federal government abandons property, more particularly a fort or a military base, that property then would revert back over to the Lakota people. And so they use the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868 to then reclaim Alcatraz Island. And they go over in 1964. And it's an occupation that lasts only about 1 hour. And there's a key individual involved in that. And her name is Belva Cottier. And she essentially does the legal framework for that occupation. And despite it only lasting an hour, the critical thing about it was is that it attracted massive news media. It captured headlines around the country. Indians take over Alcatraz Island, the famed prison that housed Al Capone, the Birdman, so on and so forth. So this captures national headlines, which is important. Belva Cottier does the legal framing. When Richard takes over at Native American Studies, the first person he hires is the community liaison for Native Studies is Belva Cottier, who did all the legal framing for that 1964 takeover. Not only that, the students are highly organized, and they're getting together with students at Berkeley. And so it's really interesting because this leadership is at least being sponsored in part by not only Richard Oakes, but Lenaida Means, who is Shoshone Bannock from Fort Hall Reservation coming out of Idaho, who moved to San Francisco on relocation. She attended Berkeley along with several other students in 1969. They created she took over an abandoned house at Berkeley and created an American Indian community house for Native studies to flourish at Berkeley. And of course, out of this, the Berkeley students and San Francisco State students hung out with one another. They knew each other through the Indian City there in the Mission District. And out of this, it was, as I say, several circumstances kind of pushed the envelope on really thinking about Alcatraz. One of those was taking a course with Dr. Jack Forbes, who is a Lenape citizen. And Jack Forbes taught these courses at the Far West Laboratory, what the students call the Far Out Labs. And he would bring in students from NIYC or the National Indian Youth Council, like Mel Thom, Clyde Warrior. And they would have rap sessions about Native liberation. They'd have rap sessions about what does it mean to be independent as a Native person, or how do we gain our freedom, and what does that freedom kind of look like? And students began to really kind of center questions on sovereignty. How do we overturn destructive policies like relocation at the times, or get them to work more effectively, at least for Native peoples? How do we overturn termination legislation, which was legislatively eradicating multiple Native nations? I think from 1953 to 1970, 109 Native nations were legislatively eradicated by Congress through termination. And so they wanted to overturn this. They wanted to create kind of a proactive response that would also change public opinion on a national scale. And this is where they kind of learned about the 64 occupation, and it stayed with them. And they began also thinking, well, let's think about taking over Alcatraz Island again. They wanted to do it in the summertime, and that would make sense for this being a student movement because students would be out of classes in the summertime, so they wouldn't have to worry about getting expelled, and they would have time to be able to set it up and stage it. But the timeline got pushed because the Indian Center in San Francisco would burn down in October of 1969. And this would really sponsor at least the Indian Center and the Indian community coming together to say, we really need to draw attention not only to Native issues, but we need a new center to be built. And one person in particular would kind of give an early release date of November to reporters that was not Richard or Lenaida. And what Richard would do is they would just kind of roll with it. And that first occupation date was to be in November of 1969, November 14th. I believe it was November 9th, sorry, of 1969. And what the students did is they organized by the dock, and they used it as theater. And Alcatraz was to be kind of a theater occupation, like the street theater that was happening all around them in the late 1960s, all through San Francisco. Use it as a way to get the press attention to start focusing on Native issues. So they get down at the docks. They were supposed to have a boat that would take them out to the island. They called all the reporters up, and this was in broad daylight. Richard reached out. He grabbed a proclamation. He began reading it. And the proclamation that was written by the community spoke to Alcatraz as being a symbol for Indian country. It was an abandoned federal prison, much like the government had abandoned Native peoples in federal Indian policy. The other side of it, too, is that there was no running water. There was no electricity. There was no occupations. In other words, no jobs. There was no mineral development. There was no future. Alcatraz became a symbol for Indian country in the late 1960s, a way of being able to talk about the current situation in Indian country and use Alcatraz as a symbol, a metaphor for that. And so they read a proclamation. Richard held out, you know, some strips of cloth and some beads mimicking the purchase of Manhattan Island some 300 years ago, offering to purchase Alcatraz Island at that point in time. And then the reporters were like, okay, well, that's great. where's the boat? So they scrambled around. They found this guy who had this triple-masted ship that looked like a pirate ship. It was actually a commissioned ship by the government of Canada to celebrate James Cook in his voyage of discovery throughout the Pacific. I marked that within quotation, an exploration. And his boat was called the Endeavour. So this was a mock ship of Captain James Cook, ship the Endeavour. It was called, renamed the Monte Cristo, and it had a guy in a kind of powder blue leisure suit with a frilly cravat, looked kind of like Austin Powers. And he essentially just said, yeah, you know, I'm flying the Canadian flag. I could use the publicity since you get all these reporters. I'll take you around the island, but I can't land on it. So the students are like, well, this is as good as it's going to get. Let's get on board and let's go. So Ronald Craig allows all the students, they come on board, about 80 or so students. He starts sail towards the island. He fires off the cannon to the reporters and everybody goes nuts. And but it's not enough for Richard. Like I said, you know, that early on kind of leadership, mimicking at least that kind of race against a boat from his youth. He goes to the bow of the boat. He takes his shirt off. He motions back to the crowd. Come on, let's go. Let's get it on. And he jumps into the frigid waters of the bay, which those waters differ about 1 degree in temperature year round. Most people have to wear dry suits to keep from freezing and swimming. I mean, there's a reason there's a federal penitentiary built on Alcatraz, right? People aren't supposed to be swimming away from it, let alone to it. And Richard decides to defy all of those constructs by jumping into the frigid bay waters, and he swims 250 yards, making it to the island, and the crowds erupt. Four other people follow him in. In other words, where the boat wouldn't take him, he would determine it himself. And this becomes kind of a point in which a lot of people in the past have pointed to this action as an action that defines self-determination in Indian country, where policy wouldn't take us any further. We would take ourselves. We would take control. We wouldn't allow anything else to limit us any longer. And out of this, it's kind of a scouting mission. They go back later that night with one loaf of bread and a couple of sleeping bags. 14 of them will take over the island. And then they decide they were going to create a D-Day time. That D-Day was going to be November 20th, 1969. And Richard uses his gift for oratory, and he travels across the state of California, going to UCLA or San Jose State and other universities to speak to other indigenous students and native students to get them to want to come and take over Alcatraz Island. And on November 20th, they do just that. They use those two prior scouting missions to launch a night attack on Alcatraz, and they land 89 students on November 20th, and this amazing kind of landing that defies the Coast Guard, defies the press, and captures the attention of the Nixon White House and makes a major rippling effect in regards to indigenous rights thereafter. So his term that you gave me, Alcatraz is not an island, it's an idea, is one of the key phrases that Richard will create within the speeches that he uses. And essentially what he means is that what they do on Alcatraz was to kind of light a torch. It was to be to start a rippling effect throughout Indian country of further occupations, the reclaiming of native lands, reclaiming of indigenous treaty rights, the reclaiming of indigenous pride and multiple constructs and indigenous literatures and indigenous histories and indigenous studies and core classes, kind of a major Renaissance era throughout Indian country. And it did just that. There was hundreds of occupations that were triggered thereafter. There was the takeover of Wrigley Field all the way to in Chicago, to the takeover of Ellis Island, even in New York. So it went bi-coastal and hundreds of other kinds of like occupations, and that Alcatraz in and of itself was to become a symbol. And others have tried to say, well, you know, red power occurred within IYC, and sure it did, but it was a slogan. Alcatraz became the symbol for red power. Alcatraz became the definition. It became the meaning for red power. And the rest of that was, you know, something that came down to rhetoric, right? Years ago, when I was working with the American Indian Movement and repatriation, I remember talking with Dennis Banks, and we sat down, and he said, you know, in those early years, you know, in the 1960s, we were all shouting sovereignty, you know, and it would get cheers anytime you said it, you know, as an activist, and you're in a crowd and organizing, you said, you know, native sovereignty, people would cheer up and yay, you know, and it would get the crowd going. But he's like, you know, we really didn't know what it meant, right? You know, but we knew it got a crowd going. It wasn't until later that we knew what it meant, right? And so this became kind of a really interesting issue in which Alcatraz was triggering something else. It was creating the definition that was needed to what Red Power is, and that it was about launching another movement, which was to reinforce Native nationalism from intertribal organizing. And so for Richard, Alcatraz is not an island, it's an idea. It meant that throughout the rest of Indian country, no matter what, if it's First Nations or if it's Central America or South America, the idea of Alcatraz was for indigenous people to begin liberating themselves, to begin channeling their new destiny and overturning destructive policies, and to start a period of decolonization that grips the Western Hemisphere. And this is where the threat of Alcatraz resides as well, which is what we would see kind of in the second half of the book. Is moving into the implementation of the idea, and the idea wasn't always pretty. It triggered a violence. It triggered a violence that hit Richard Oakes in the home with the loss of his daughter on the island, and which would precipitate him leaving by January of 1970. But while they were on the island, even before the loss of his daughter, they began creating a newsletter. They created their own radio station. They were highly organized. They began doing repairs on the island. They wanted to create a new center, an assembly in which people that came into the West Coast would first see Indian land. A museum and a university is what they also wanted to create. They began creating their own Indian city, an idyllic Indian city that was free and liberated on Alcatraz Island, and they created a Mecca. Over 10,000 Native people would make their way to Alcatraz Island to be a part of this movement. Over a period of 19 months that they would hold the island, one of the longest occupations, at least in American Indian history, but in kind of the 20th century political sphere in the sense of occupations. And they triggered a movement that is still with us today that would inspire things like I Don't Know More, as well as the current, you know, in 2016, at least the stand at Standing Rock against DAPL and the continuation of a pipeline underneath the Sacred Missouri River there at Standing Rock Reservation. So out of that, yeah, one can see at least Richard was kind of prophetic. He had his finger on the pulse of Native politics during the time, and that he was really at a cornerstone of creating and launching this kind of new movement as we know it today as Red Power. And that phrasing becomes central to understanding the definition and philosophy and ideology behind Red Power.
Tell us, as we start to wrap up the book here, about the final years of Richard's life, and then kind of more broadly, and you touched on this a minute ago, but how you see his legacy and the legacy of the Alcatraz occupation more generally.
Okay, that's a big question,
right.
And I will try my best to summarize. After this, Richard gets involved at Fort Lawton. They take over an abandoned military fort. Seattle, they construct an organization named after the organization on Alcatraz, and they call themselves United Indians of All Tribes. And I always have to remind my students, you know, with Alcatraz, that AIM was not involved in the Alcatraz takeover. And tons of people always give credit of Alcatraz to the American Indian Movement. That is absolutely false. It was the Indians of All Tribes that occupied that as an organizational structure. So that idea spreads then to Fort Lawton, and they're successful. After three attempts to take over Fort Lawton, eventually through Model Cities funding, they're actually granted a portion of Fort Lawton, which today is the Daybreak Star Indian Center in Seattle. So Richard actually leaves Alcatraz. They have success. I mean, Nixon administration by 1970 returns Taos Blue Lake to Taos Pueblo. He also overturns and ends termination legislation. So he puts an end effectively to termination. He begins pulling back on also relocation, which will end by 1972 officially. So what's interesting is that he's meeting multiple successes. And of course, Alcatraz is caught by the national press, the international press. Reporters from Germany and Japan and China and from all around the world are talking about this movement of indigenous rights and what does it mean for indigenous peoples and what is this term, red power? And out of this, he begins to think about moving it to native liberation at Pitt River. And Pitt River had about 3.5 million acres of land in Northern California, and this was unceded land. They never signed a treaty. They never ceded this over to the federal government. And over the years, multinational corporations like Kimberly-Clark Corporation or Pacific Gas and Electric, which has been in the news recently, PG&E Corporation moved in and began taking valuable resources, constructing dams, hydroelectric facilities, taking resources off Pitt River land without any compensation to Pitt River Nation. The Indian Claims Commission wanted to give them 47 cents an acre for that land. Pitt River denied it, like the Lakota denied ever selling away their sacred Black Hills. It was the same for Pitt River Nation. So they began organizing with Richard Oakes and Indians of all tribes out at Alcatraz, and that Indians of all tribes, you know, like that idea, moved beyond the island itself. And they began taking over PG&E campgrounds and PG&E facilities and getting arrested. And when the cops came to arrest them, they were curious as to why all the native peoples were laughing and why Richard would be smiling at getting arrested. And part of it was is that they needed to be charged with trespass. And Aubrey Grossman, who is one of the lawyers for the Alcatraz occupation, it kind of found this clause, which is to say that, you know, if you're arrested for trespass, you've got to prove that you have legal title to that land. What he understood was is none of the corporations had legal title to that land. So as things got heated up, they also began, at least Richard tried to serve a citizen's arrest on the head of PG&E Corporation in downtown San Francisco. And in so doing, it drew kind of unprecedented attention to this corporation. And also, it began to get stockholders a little bit weary. Like, would PG&E have to pay back, at least for resources that it had taken from Pitt River Nation, especially if this was eventually decided in a court of law? They were winning these cases, too. There was a judge that found them not guilty of trespass because at least Pitt River maintained original title to that land, and that was creating a court precedence. Out of this kind of network, Richard had multiple attempts on his life. In 1972, in September of that, would equate to the final attempt on his life. And of course, he led multiple occupations, not only at Pitt River. He would lead occupations to return Rattlesnake Island. He would lead occupations with the LM Pomo at Clear Lake and the takeover of lands. He also was advocating the creation of toll roads for roads that went through reservation lands well before at least the president of the Navajo Nation would put down a tree and try to create a toll road at, through the Navajo Nation. Richard had done it in the 1970s by cutting down a tree and putting it across the lands at Kashaya, where his wife's family was from, as far as Kashaya Pomo, and charging people money to go pass through the reservation or pass through native lands. So he was probably the most iconic figure of the period. He was known nationally as a native leader, and he was making waves in Northern California. Well, in 1972, in September, he would be shot and killed, assassinated, as I call it in the book, by a guy named Michael Oliver Morgan, who was a YMCA day camp director in a camp that was located not too far from Kashaya. Richard had been walking down Skag Springs Road. He was going to go there to the Y to meet with an attorney from California Indian Legal Services to talk about the Y camp being a part of Kashaya land or the original land base and having those lands returned back to Kashaya. Michael Morgan would take had two prior attempts. I have to kind of summarize it as quickly as possible. Two prior attempts on Richard Oakes' life where he pulled out a gun. And each of those attempts, Richard would actually turn his back on Morgan and Richard had also suffered from paralysis. He had a debilitating beating that he had to basically pull himself back to life from. And so he kind of walked with a limp. He wasn't that fast at this point in time. And Morgan would take a loaded Welder P-38 9mm gun, basically a German Luger. He would meet up with Richard on the road. He would claim that Richard jumped out from behind a tree, attacked him with a knife, and in self-defense, he had to shoot Richard Oakes. What we know from looking at the historical record and looking at a lot of the FBI files and like documents is that is simply untrue. Michael Morgan would be arrested, initially charged with first-degree murder after killing Richard Oakes with a single shot. Those charges within a period of 1 hour would be dropped to involuntary, voluntary manslaughter. And then eventually in 1973 in Northern California Court of Law, during the height of the Wounded Knee takeover, Michael Oliver Morgan was found not guilty of killing Richard Oakes. Well, Richard's death would lead other Native leaders like Hank Adams, who was part of the Survival American Indians Association and responsible for working on the Fissions movement throughout the Pacific Northwest. He would say, we need a march on Washington. And so he would begin organizing people in Denver, Colorado to stage this march on Washington in 1972. And so he pulled together members of the American Indian movement coming out of Minneapolis, members of the Indians of all tribes out of San Francisco, members of United Indians of all tribes out of Seattle, and they started a caravan march on Washington, which would end up in the takeover of the BIA buildings in 1972. And most people don't realize is that that takeover was coming out of Richard Oakes' assassination and the fury that people had, especially with this killer that was going to be found not guilty. In which there needed to be a make a stand for showcasing this kind of dual sense of justice for Indians in America. Out of this, we then come to the legacy. And, you know, it took me a long time. I kind of write about this in the conclusion of the book. And, you know, part of that legacy was, is, you know, oftentimes the way scholars had written about Alcatraz is it was a failure, right? You know, the students, they were there for 19 months. You know, it wasn't turned into a cultural center. It wasn't turned into a university. Even though their Big Rock school that they founded would later be replicated in San Francisco, their coalition politic in which they worked with the Black Panthers as well as the Brown Berets and others would see their activism replicated in the Brown Berets takeover of Catalina Island in Los Angeles, or even the Black Panther Party doing breakfast programs, at least for its youth. The Black Panthers had worked security for Alcatraz. They created an element of coalition politics that is something that 60s scholars tend to sometimes miss in the equation of Alcatraz's greater meaning to understanding the 1960s. But the casting of Alcatraz as a failure was something that I really took to task in this book. And I end it in kind of looking at my experience as a young Native scholar and coming to study Alcatraz. And I'd kind of seen all the pictures of the graffiti, which is a misnomer. The veterans of the movement all tell you to say, you have to say it's a political statement. And I think that's really important. So all throughout the island were painted slogans like, you know, free or on a shield or, you know, home of the free. You know, people would paint their native nations in order to broadcast it, red power slogans. And out of this, you know, I kind of studied some of those images and, you know, the Mission District was big on creating political statements and community art that replicated elements of the politics of the community. So it kind of made sense that that would be a way to tag the island and draw attention to Native politics. But I didn't quite get it until I went to the island, and it was prior to, I think, 2001 that I went out there, kind of late 1990s, early 2000s. And I remember getting on the boat and, you know, you get on the boat, you can hear the sea lions kind of squawking in the background. You can hear the seagulls over you. You can see the superstructure of the Golden Gate Bridge. And you're kind of going out there and you can kind of feel the waves hitting you and the sea spray hitting you in the face. And I remember going to the front of the boat because I was like, oh, I want to see where Richard probably would have jumped off, right? I want to see what he saw. So I go to the front of the boat and I'm kind of getting excited and the boat kind of veers up and goes around, you know, Alcatraz and it goes to the dock. And it just literally gave me goosebumps when I saw it for the first time. But it was this sign that said, you know, Indians of all tribes or Indians welcome, right? And it was the first, as a Native person, it was the first welcome sign I'd ever seen in my own homelands. And it spoke to me. It gave me that kind of message. It resonated with me. And that what Alcatraz became was sacred space. What Alcatraz became is this messenger. It became this place in which a movement started, a movement that's still speaking and educating people about indigenous rights. Because as I got off that boat and I had people putting their headphones in because they wanted to hear about the Birdman or they wanted to see Alcatraz's most notorious criminal like Al Capone in his cell. They wanted to see what I realized the toughest criminals in the world. I was there to see the toughest Indians in the world. And what they were getting along the way is an education about Native politics, because the first thing the Park Service makes you do is gather underneath the Indians' welcome sign at Alcatraz Island. They begin to explain away the occupation of Alcatraz Island in 1969 and how it served as a cornerstone and foundation for the launching of an indigenous rights movement that it basically has taken over the Western Hemisphere, and we're still seeing the ramifications from. So the legacy of this movement is enormous, and it cannot be understated any longer or seen as a failure any longer. It has to be understood in new ways, and I hope that what this book does in the end as part of that legacy is it ignites a fire for more Red Power scholarship, but also more scholarship on the urban Indian experience, more scholarship in the sense of Native biographies and getting out to the community and interviewing people that live this history in this very dynamic and turbulent era, and that out of this we become or we get a more richer experience of what it means to be a contemporary or a modern Indian in this time period beyond just the 19th century views or histories that we have out there.
I know this book has not been out very long, but I always like to wrap up my interviews on this channel by getting a preview of what the guest is working on next. So can you tell us if you have any other projects that you've begun since this book has been released just last year?
Yeah, so the second and third book, there's actually, I guess, three projects, which it kind of happens when you ask scholars what they're doing. So we're always working on multiple projects. So I'm working on an anthology right now called Indian Cities with Kathleen Cahill, who's from Penn State University, as well as Andrew Needham. And that anthology has a number of authors that are in it that are exploring that greater issue of Indian cities in multiple different frames and networks, going from kind of the 18th century all the way up into the present. And that is with the Clement Center and will be with University of Oklahoma Press. And I'm one of the editors of that. And then a second project that I'm doing is a book on the Native American Rights Fund, which was started in 1970 and came out of the California Indian Legal Services. And they wanted to create a kind of national office. And this kind of became our NAACP. And over 20 different cases would eventually be tried before the Supreme Court that has links to NARF, as well as a lot of that self-determination legislation, like the 26 pieces of self-determination legislation that came out of the launching of Alcatraz, but also the legal work of that behind the scenes. So I kind of wanted to take a legal approach and look at this really influential organization and begin to write its history at the cusp of its own 50th anniversary. And beyond that is another project, which is to kind of open up Red Power and see it in multiple capacities. And that's a book on Red Power and pop culture, in which I have chapters on Red Power and comics and Red Power and film. I start off with looking at Indian rodeo, going all the way from Jackson Sundown to the present, and sport. So it's kind of picking up on Phil DeLoria's Indians in Unexpected Places, but moving it to a more of 1945 and thereafter in these different vignettes and exploring how how Red Power is not just confined to the politic, as Buffy St. Marie so demonstrated with her powerful quote I gave at the beginning, that it's something that even the stage has a presence with understanding what Red Power is and its ideology and philosophies. And so I look at Native rock and roll, Native theater as another kind of construct of Red Power. So kind of the I guess you could say the sequel of Richard Oakes is bound in those two books that I've been working on simultaneously. And beyond that is I've been executive director of the American Indian Digital History Project, which is trying to get a lot of these underground newspapers like Akwesasne Notes and others like the original journals for the Society for American Indians. I've been trying to get those digitized, and we launched a site in which is free and open access, trying to create that digital revolution so that our communities have access to these archival sources that we enjoy as historians. So people can find that at the American Indian Digital History Project. And then beyond that is to be involved in the 50th anniversary for the takeover. November 20th, 2019, there will be a massive celebration in San Francisco Bay. So I created an exhibit called Not Your Indians Anymore that focuses on objects and ephemera and media that came out of the Alcatraz occupation that's currently traveling around the country to build up steam and get people enticed and excited to go out to Alcatraz to celebrate that 50th anniversary of the takeover in November. So just a few things on the plate.
Yeah, you've been a little busy, it sounds like, lately. Kent Blancett is the Charles and Mary Caldwell Martin Professor of Western American History at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. And his newest book is A Journey to Freedom, Richard Oakes, Alcatraz, and the Red Power Movement, which came out with Yale University Press in 2018. Thank you so much for talking with me today, Kent.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun, and I love having the opportunity to be able to talk about Richard or Alcatraz at any point. So thank you for the platform.